Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes on the Zero Point Show. It is March 19th, year 2011. I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. The Zero Point Show is used to explore esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings, as well as modern science, as well as looking at contemporary issues and the crises of humankind on this planet. I would say we live in a very critical time of human history, and a lot of very major events are occurring internationally and to this planet, with implications for this planet. I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca. The CA stands for Canada. And on my website, I have four books available that I've produced so far. One is The Heart Doctrine, explaining the claim or idea that human consciousness and the I experience originates out of the human heart. And in this book, I'm saying that the last century of modern psychology has been mistaken in assuming what I call the head doctrine, which is the belief that the material brain produces consciousness, and that consciousness is centered in the head, where the mind is. Okay, mystical teachings offer an alternative view that suggests your true self or I originates out of the heart. So the heart, throughout the mystical literature, is seen as a sacred space. God is within the heart, or Christ is within the heart, or Lord Krishna says, I am within the heart. So the idea or concept is a human individual I, like a monad or divine spark or a spiritual spark, is associated with the human heart. And this is the life principle within the material body. So its electrodynamics generate the heart's beat, which brings life into the body through the circulation of the blood. And so the heart is the life principle, and I suggest that human consciousness is the light of the self. This element within the heart is described as self-illuminating, like the sun. That's how Swami Prabhupada describes it. So the concept is there's this divine spark or God spark or Jiva Atma, it's called in Vedic teachings. This is within the heart, within its higher dimensions. It's not so much that it's within the heart as it is behind. The heart originates out of this higher dimensional center. So in a way, consciousness and life in the body are due to the spiritual element within the heart. So the Heart Doctrine book explores that teaching of the Heart Doctrine in all different mystical teachings. And the second book I have is called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And it's based on comparative studies of Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine with modern physics and cosmology. And it's remarkable that Blavatsky's work over a century ago anticipated many modern ideas concerning such things as vacuum genesis, which in a way means creation out of nothingness or seeming nothingness. Okay, Blavatsky described the void, which is the plenum. And similarly, in modern science, they now think of the quantum vacuum as this void, but at a zero-point level, it is the plenum, has all these energies and potencies within it. and Blavatsky described the origin of the universe from a point center. She drew a circle and put a point in the center, and she described that as depicting the first point origin of the universe. And similarly, in modern science now, we believe that the universe originated from what they call a singularity at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So the modern scientist has arrived at the same mystical concept of the origin of the universe from a point source. Okay, and in the secret doctrine, this idea is applied also to ourself. It's like we have a similarly first point source origin. Blavatsky calls it a Leia center. My third book, you can see up on my website, is entitled Psychological Illusions. And it's a broad overview of the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, the fourth way teaching. And it gives a very practical overview of the issues of psychology and a very valuable method of self-study. It explains how human beings have different centers, like intellectual, emotional, and moving instinctual and sexual centers. We have different centers or different aspects to ourselves, and these are separate from consciousness. Consciousness is like light that allows you to be aware of the activities of these different centers. Gurdjieff has a very valuable psychology distinguishing between a person's essence, like what is real in the person or in their essential nature, versus what is personality. And personality is what is acquired from without. So it's like a persona or a mask, and it masks your essential self. So in the Gurdjieff teaching, Gurdjieff says how we have to allow for the growth of essence in a person, in an individual, whereas in modern times people become dominated by personality and their conditioning and so-called education, and they form false personality and they lose their essence. They form a false consciousness system. So the Gurdjieff teaching is about how do we awaken. How do we study ourselves and then free ourselves of those patterns of conditioning which limit our awareness? And the last work I have available is a book entitled The Slugs, which is an exposition of Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And The Slugs is what Jim and I are going to be talking about today in our further explorations of Gurdjieff and his classic tale. Okay, so I do have all four books available, and I have sample chapters of all my books available up on my site. And I do encourage people to sample my readings there, as well as a variety of other articles I have up there. And I do accept donations if anyone cares to support someone, myself, for the kinds of work I do. My books are also available through Amazon, so they're quite easy to order anywhere throughout North America. Okay, so I just invite on my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Oh, so a lot of major things, isn't that? This just terrible, this over in China. Oh my God, the quake, if that wasn't bad enough, then they had the tsunami, and if that wasn't bad enough, this nuclear accident is terrible.
Yeah,
and still unresolved. Sorry, Jim?
You said China, it's Japan.
Sorry, did I say China?
Yeah.
Wow, goodness, yeah.
Yes. No, it's like, it's sort of incomprehensibly bad. It's string of events all occurring one after another. I anticipate the chain reaction and the nuclear situation is so, I mean, it's, you know, they're saying it's at least as bad now as Three Mile Island, if not worse. And, you know, it just shows how, you know, interdependent everything is on everything else, and that, you know, if you throw some sort of, you know, unforeseen or exceptional circumstance into things, it there's no way out, and you know that's what happened there in terms of the reactor. Apparently, who knows what's going to happen? I mentioned this before on this program. There's a very interesting book called Arsenals of Folly by Richard Rhodes, which is it's about the Cold War, and especially about Reagan and Gorbachev and the attempts to get a grip on the arms race. But the first chapter of that book is all about what happened at Chernobyl, and it's just, I mean, Chernobyl is so exceptional. It's just like the construction was so bad to start with, but the Russian government, the Soviet government at the time, their response to everything was basically just to pretend that it wasn't happening, and mm-hmm. I mean, it was just such a dramatically horrific event, and you know, potentially the danger was they really had no clue as to how to deal with it, and were completely incompetent, and you know, realistically, the eventual solution to it, they were actually kind of lucky that things didn't. Were even worse than they were, but you know, the effects are still being felt there. You know, that was 1985, and I think the construction was a lot better in Japan, and the systems were a lot better. But it just shows how dangerous nuclear power can be. You know, our nuclear proponents always want to reassure you how safe everything is, but you know, if there is something does go wrong, it's just the effects are just so dramatically horrific that you know, you really wonder.
Yeah, and once again, you wonder, like, how honest the government and media will be about it. Like, it's amazing. I've been listening to the Alex Jones show this last week, and he's had amazing coverage of Japan, like, really focusing on that with all kinds of experts on there, physicists and nuclear people, and excellent coverage, and even phone calls, like opening his lines up to Japan. And he had one person called in Japan, and this person was back in the States but had been keeping in touch with friends in Japan, and this place east of Tokyo but kind of south of where the nuclear plant was, the people in the street, the people in the town were getting splotches on their skin and sickness, like radiation sickness and such. Like, you know, I think again, I don't think we're told the truth. They kind of tell you afterwards when it becomes evident. But apparently the winds are supposed to kind of shift and carry more of this contamination towards Tokyo. And that's such a huge city, 37 million people or something in Tokyo.
Well,
yeah.
The big thing there is that's pretty obvious from just the mainstream coverage is that the Japanese government is telling people something very different from what everybody else is being told. Like, all the foreign nationals were told to get out, you know. And yet the Japanese government kept reassuring people, just stay indoors and everything will be okay. This is, you know, this is south of the reactor. And I was like, well, I don't think I'd trust that. You know, I heard a Japanese lady on the phone the other night, and she was pregnant, so she and her husband left.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Her husband was French, and the message they were getting from France and their friends were getting from France was completely different from the message that they were getting from their own government. So, like, again,
yeah.
you know, they don't want people to panic, but at the same time, you know, you owe a duty of care to your citizens and to lie about something like that is just incomprehensible that anybody would do that. Because, and I mean, of course, you know.
Yeah, because of the further risk it puts them at.
And you know, we're talking about, you know, like, you know, such incredibly small amounts, it can be so dangerous, you know. The irony, of course, too, is that this is Japan, where, you know, the only place where their atomic bombs have actually been detonated, you know, and of course, mm-hmm. Japan has a whole history in terms of their effects of radiation sickness, and, you know, where thousands and thousands and thousands of people died because of radiation sickness. So this is, you know, boy, just as I say, it's very difficult to fathom what's going on there. And also, you know, it brings up questions. I was reading something on Truth Out about, by Greg Palast, American journalist who works there in Britain, a very good, very interesting journalist, and just about throughout the nuclear industry, how much, you know, how much cover-up there is of dangers and cost-cutting and you know, just bad construction. And so you have to wonder, you know, like, what exactly, you know, what did happen there? I mean, I obviously, an earthquake and a tsunami, that's a bit of a problem. You know, like, I'm not sure to what extent you could even deal with that. But, you know, again, it brings back the whole question of nuclear safety, because it's not like anything else. Like, I mean, this is just on an entirely different level of scale in terms of the danger, you know. So.
And then, I mean, there seems to be other areas of incompetence. Like, what I've heard is that they had stored the spent nuclear rods over top of the main nuclear, like the main rods, the active rods. So when they exploded, it blew all those rods, 600,000 rods apparently, like, are stored on site there. This is what was reported on Alex Jones and on alternative media, was that they had stored all the spent fuel rods there. And that when the explosions occurred, like, these were being blown up as part of it. Yeah, this is one of the things being maintained. And yeah, so I mean, have to pray that just somehow it resolves without eventuating in a major kind of nuclear explosion. I mean, that the material, you know, it is reportedly, you know, to the coast of BC and California now, even though it won't maybe initially be very poisonous, but I mean, if this is an ongoing emergency, then over time there's going to be more and more of this particulate radiologically active materials. I mean, well, it's very, very serious.
You know what they did at Chernobyl, eh? Like, they buried it, basically.
Oh, did they? No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
oh.
They just poured, you know, an incredible amount of earth on it and sealed it with concrete. You know, that's how they contained it. They didn't really contain it. That was the whole point, is that, you know, everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and because they were so incompetent and in such denial that, you know, this is an incredible disaster, they didn't respond properly, and they ended up just dumping a whole lot of dirt on it, basically. I mean, that's not a very scientific explanation, but that's exactly what they did. And that's what I saw was that's what they were trying to do, or that was the sort of the backup plan, because, you know, they were trying to restore this cable to start the cooling system. Like, that was the idea, is that, you know, part of what happened, is that the power went out. So with no power, all the cooling system shut down, and the backup generators were all knocked out too, so they couldn't operate the cooling system. So, you know, you just don't expect people to be terribly forthright or honest about something of this magnitude, so who knows what exactly is there. But, I mean, it just sort of takes you back, you know. It's only 40 years ago that... I mean, this sort of speaks to human ignorance on a whole variety of levels, but, you know, that nuclear testing was conducted in the open atmospheric testing in the States, right? And and you know, like
in the States,
in Russia and the States. Well, a lot of it was done in the Pacific, you know.
But yeah,
they didn't do it in their backyard. They did it in the atolls in the Pacific, but the Russians did it, you know, all over the place. But the thing was that. I read this thing that President Kennedy was talking to his science advisor, and he was explaining to him, like, you know, when you explode a bomb, the radioactivity, like, it gets in the rain and it falls and it's everywhere. And so Kennedy was saying, so it's like it's in the atmosphere and then it comes to the ground. And it's like he didn't know.
Yeah.
He was the president of the United States and, you know, in charge of the nuclear arsenal. He didn't know, and he was a pretty smart guy, you know, I mean, and then, you know, like 20 years later, some idiot in Reagan's administration says, you know, well, you can fight a nuclear war, you know, all you really need is enough shovels because, you know, what you do is you dig a hole in the ground and you get a couple of doors and you cover them with dirt. Dirt's a really good thing, and as long as we have got enough shovels, everybody's going to make it. That guy was a senior Reagan administration official, and he was not alone in terms of his complete ignorance of what, you know, what nuclear radiation is about. And if you read Richard Rhodes' book, Arsenals of Folly, the Russians are just as stupid, if not stupider, you know. So, I mean, it just goes to show you that all these hasnosmas individuals in charge of these weapons and the people they surrounded themselves with have reached more than their level of incompetence, you know. I'm laughing, but it's kind of gallows laughter. It's just like it's almost incomprehensible that anybody this stupid could be in such an incredibly, you know, responsible position that we could come to this point where we have these things.
Yes.
And, you know, as I say, those are nuclear bombs. This is a nuclear reactor. You know, too, that, you know...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, that there's a plan to transport nuclear waste from the Grey Bruce reactor through the Great Lakes.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's our government.
To where are they going with it?
I think it's going to Europe. I think that's where it's going, but I know it's going through the Great Lakes. That just doesn't seem like a very good plan to me, you know? Something happens and it gets into the water in the Great Lakes. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, well, they had the release from Pickering this week. Did you hear that?
No.
Yeah, well, they released like so many hundreds of thousands of liters of radioactive water into Lake Ontario.
Well, yeah, there's been problems going on there for a long, long time. That reactor is not safe, and then they have in the neighboring areas they have cancer rates that are disproportionate to what they should be, and of course, you know, they're told everything's okay, but clearly it isn't. That's not very far from me, of course. I would be in that situation if the Pickering reactor were to explode or something was to happen there. You know, Lake Toronto, the whole Greater Toronto Area would be contaminated.
Yeah, it would become so. Yeah, all southern Ontario would.
It's only like 25 miles from downtown Toronto.
Yeah. It's really quite terrible. So we'll just have to see how it unfolds. Hopefully there are catastrophic possibilities, I guess, if it exploded and then, you know, worldwide distribution of this kind of particulate matter. It could really, you know, affect the people, firstly, of the west coast of North America, and of Japan, and people of Tokyo are obviously going to get badly dosed with this.
Yeah, Korea and China, and
continues to spew out.
Yeah,
terrible.
Yeah. Southeast Asia. I mean, good Lord, who knows where? You know, like, I don't know where, you know, would all go, but.
I had the thought. I wonder if the boys will meet at Bohemian Grove this summer. They can maybe find each other in the dark. They'll it'd be irradiating.
Well, Well, that's one thing, is that there's no escaping it, you know, no matter who you are, you know, like if you're a peon, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, there really is no escaping it. That's It's in the atmosphere, it's in the water, it's in the ground, it's in the food, you know, it's everybody's going to feed on it. That's as I say, we're talking about such microscopically small numbers in terms of exposure, in terms of the danger, eh? Like, I mean, that's what's so frightening about it all. But
really, it's we have to see what happens. I know. I was trying to remember what I was going to say before. Yeah, and they do have underground bases. That's why a lot of these elites, I think they worry less about these things a bit, because they do have these massive bases.
I just find that completely, like, you know, sorry, I just, you know, I know there are underground bunkers and things for people, like, you know, in terms of nuclear, but, you know, when you're talking about nuclear, like I say, it's like that's sort of a more advanced version of enough shovels, you know. It's like there's no escaping this, you know. There's no way that anybody would meaningfully or intentionally want to do this. It's just so, like, pervasive, and there's no real escape from it, you know. Like, that's, I mean, that would be my interpretation of things. It's like this is just like, you know, it's a terrible accident, and I don't trust people to tell the truth about what's happening. Like, I definitely, as I say, they're clearly not telling, the Japanese government is clearly not telling the truth about that. But to go beyond that is, like, you know, I would be worried. You know, I would be worried no matter who I was by.
Yeah, no, it could change the history on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they say Chernobyl, like, caused over 1 million deaths and like, all through Europe. It spread all through Europe. And then it went around the world, like,
The only reason that people knew that it had even happened was because all of a sudden radiation detectors in Scandinavia started going off. Eh? That's how
knew.
The Soviet government was not recognizing that it had happened. And then all of a sudden all these radiation detectors were going on. People were like, what the hell is going on? And it was drifting across northern Germany and into Scandinavia. Like, you know, that's how they knew. So that's like, and as you say, like, you know, prevailing wind currents and you know, it can go all over the globe, you know, and in fact it will, on some level, probably will go all over the globe, and, you know, obviously be more and more diminished in terms of its effect and you know, diluted, but still, you know, once it gets in the atmosphere, it's in the atmosphere. So
I remember when the native elder Sequoia, who I observed, he would do prayers, and he'd have his eagle's feather, and he'd be burning smudge, and he'd kind of smudge the directions, and it was like he would put his prayers, he said, into the smoke, and the smoke would go off, he would smudge it in all the directions, and the idea was that eventually kind of circulates, and that spreads the prayers all around the whole earth, eh?
Yeah,
and it reminds me of this, because it shows you, like, no one's going to escape this, you know. I mean, matter of time. I mean, it's going to affect the northern hemisphere before it affects the southern. Even though the people down in Malaysia and Australia, I mean, they must be very concerned about it.
Yeah.
And then you hear that had you heard that what people are recommending as food supplements to take, or medicinal supplements, is just potassium
iodine.
I went up, and there wasn't any at my store, but they didn't normally carry it. I bought some kelp tablets, you know, just to have something, a good source of natural iodine, so that, you know, if you know that the wind is circulating, then you have some natural iodine.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, wow, that's quite a situation. We'll just pray that it's resolved. And so, yeah, and now we have another war begun over. It looks like the NATO forces are going to attack Libya Gaddafi, I think, even though I'm not really sure. It seems that I don't really understand that situation. They have a no-fly zone.
They have a no-fly zone, yeah. It's hard to make out what to make of all that, because Gaddafi is obviously, he's a despot, and there's nothing commendable about him. I mean, if he were to be knocked out of power, and clearly there's been all sorts of abuses, like he brought these mercenaries in and was paying people by the head for massacring people, so.
Yeah.
It's funny because this is odd, Like, in a way, the West has boxed themselves in, and particularly the United States has boxed itself into the situation where now, the military is saying, we can't get involved in another war in the Middle East, But this is one where the international community really should be involved and should respond and insert itself. But the perception of it, of course, especially in the Middle East amongst the Arabs and the people who live in the Middle East is going to be quite different. I noticed too that on Truth Out they have a thing that. Where some media group watches the coverage, and there's hardly any coverage of what's happening in Bahrain and Yemen, where there's also things going on. It's all focused on Libya, and there's also rebellions and uprisings there, but they're getting very, very little coverage, So this is like I say, this is the kind of the irony is that this is a situation where the West and the stronger powers really could intervene and could do something good, but because they've already intervened when they shouldn't have, they've really sort of hamstrung themselves in terms of now there's a legitimate need for international intervention, and the politics of it are so difficult, so it's hard to see what's going to happen or what should happen, I don't really profess to be any sort of expert on Libya or anything, but I know that Gaddafi's an idiot, and that he's not a good guy, and that he's a tyrant, and that people are being murdered there because it's very clear that that's happening, so...
But he's another one of these tyrants, though, who was a friend and ally and part of the gang until recently.
But he wasn't, and then he was. The funny thing is that I read an article about that all of these uprisings are showing the very unsavory connections between the CIA and these autocratic rulers in the Middle East. Because at one point, he was branded a terrorist by the Reagan administration and, was bombed and they tried to kill him and he was told he was being put out of business and then, eventually he responded and then he came over to the other side, to a certain extent, so it's like, I just know I just know that nobody's going to shed any tears if this guy gets knocked out of power, and I'd like to see him go, but it's like I say, it's a very enormously complex situation now because of everything that preceded it, And speaking of radiation, I was reading about depleted uranium in Iraq and the effects on the population there. Oh, my God. Ongoing, the birth defects and just the horrific consequences of using this. And, of course, the irony is that this is used in the weapons. It not only harms the people that they're shot at, but it harms all of the innocent bystanders and also the people who are firing them because, the American military personnel that have been involved in that, they've suffered for the consequences too, you just can't
get around. Yeah, deformed children and...
Oh, and just terrible health effects, and it's good luck getting anything out of your government, they ask you to go over and fight and die and get injured and maimed, but, try getting any money out of them for what's done to you.
You face denial and
total cover-up.
Delay and...
Yeah,
it's terrible. I heard the other day even that the effects of it had been major on Israeli men, and apparently, the sperm count was, down 40%, and that was... it's not that... this stuff just over time, it just... The dust and the wind and everything, it just gets stirred around more and more. It affects everybody.
Very disturbing that, again... Somebody actually sat down and thought about this and came up with this, you know? Like, what kind of mind? You know, I have an idea. It's like, we'll make these weapons with depleted uranium in them. Just,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, think of that. Like, and then I was reading, as I said, I was reading this thing about, you know, the birth defects in Iraqi children is just like unbelievably grotesque things that you know, that the effects that these have had.
Yeah, and they must all be illegal. I mean, it's like there's complete violation of international law. It's like there's complete lawlessness at an international level. You know, it's really quite astonishing, you know, and all these fine words, like the UN, and like, what a farce, you know?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, essentially in terms of the American government, the American military, is that they long ago just decided that they wouldn't comply with any international treaties or obligations. So, you know, that they won't join the International Court of Justice, and they wouldn't sign the landmine treaty, and they won't, you know, sign chemical weapons treaties, and they, you know, they're not going to sign anything, and they're not going to abide by them. You know, it's that simple. And when Afghanistan and Iraq came along, they wouldn't adhere to the Geneva Convention. You know, Geneva Conventions on prisoners of war. So, you know, we'll just declare them enemy combatants and throw them in black sites and throw them in Guantanamo. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, and they're spreading freedom and democracy. I mean, this is where the, you know, like Gurdjieff's comment about all the lies and fine words and rubbish that people speak, and, you know, in which they basically lie about what they do and what their intentions are. This is like, you know, Exhibit A. This is exactly what it is. But, you know, there's nothing new in any of this. It's just reached an Orwellian level of absurdity.
Yeah.
What is kind of new a bit is
the fact that, like, with nuclear weapons, I mean, you think depleted uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, kind of.
Yeah, well,
you use that, you desecrate an area of land for a long period of time beyond, so it's not just our own little war to be wiped away with the sands of time, kind of, but it's a longer implications for the planet.
Yeah, I mean, all of the, nuclear weapons changed everything, but chemical weapons did too, with, you know, like I was reading about the effects, the ongoing effects on the land in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War, you know,
Agent
Orange and the defoliants that were, you know, sprayed all over Vietnam, you know, Laos and Cambodia, you know.
I was spreading democracy too there.
Yeah, I was spreading democracy.
Democracy over there.
Agent Orange has dioxin in it, you know, which is super poisonous, you know. Marines used to drink it. They used to drink it. That was the rite of passage. The guys who were spraying it, they would drink it.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
And what were the effects of that?
Well, they all died. Well, I got sick when they came home. Like, but not just drinking it, but from spraying it. And then they tried to get the government to compensate them. And you know, that lawsuit went on for 25 years.
Yeah, until they're all dead.
Yeah, well, that's
they
why,
wear them
you
down.
Know, well, I guess it went on for 15 or 20 years, but it went on for a long, long time. I mean, and that's exactly like it's the same thing with Gulf War syndrome. You know, that war is almost 20 years old now, and it's the same thing. All sorts of people who fought in that got super sick, you know, in a variety of ways, like and you know, like central nervous system disorders and, you know, lung infections and cancers of the organs. I mean, it's just like, you know, the things that these people were exposed to is just like, you know, criminal. But again, who are the idiots? You know, I mean, idiot is too kind a word. Who are the barbarians who come up with this stuff, you know? Oh, wait a minute. Your friendly folks at Dow Chemical. And various other fine establishments, you know. It's like, you know, it's just when you read material like that alongside Beelzebub, you realize that, you know, that Gurdjieff's diagnosis of the pathology of the three brain beings of planet Earth is he might have been a little bit kind, you know. Like, I mean, even he might have been shocked by where we are now. I've been reading this very interesting book, which I'll try to get a copy and send it to you. It's not easily available, but I would like you to read it. It's called The World According to Washington, An Asian View by Patwant Singh. He's a Sikh historian and political writer, and it's an Asian perspective, basically, on the post-Second World War American imperialism, and especially from an Asian perspective. Very, very interesting book, very well written. And that's where he talks a lot about, you know, the effects in Vietnam and Indonesia and Iraq and Afghanistan of you know, military adventures and the effects,
yeah,
on the population, not just simply in killing people, but just what has been done to the land. You know, it's a very, very interesting book. It's very well documented too. So, But again,
yeah, it's like
the evidence is so overwhelming.
Yeah, it's so tragic. It's like, even in the States, like the military leaders, like in a way, they don't serve the people of the States, and they don't even serve their own soldiers. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would say. Yeah, they don't serve their own people. I mean, you always
no.
hear thanks. You know, thanks to the military for keeping us safe. But I mean, I completely disagree with it. Not keeping you safe, you know. Like, and they don't serve the people. They don't serve the interests of the country. They serve the interest of an elite that makes a lot of money.
Exactly.
From these adventures, and, you know, keeps the war economy going. The United States has been in a war economy since the entry into the Second World War. And there's a huge amount of money is generated from that. And you could take that money and all that money that goes into their military budget, you could take a huge chunk out of that. You could have free health care for every citizen of the United States. You could have good education for every citizen of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, that money could be so much better spent. But, of course, it would take that money from that very small percentage of people at the top, and it would redistribute it to people below. And these guys have absolutely no intention of letting that happen. It's really that simple. Like, you know, there's
yeah,
that big straight line in the, you know, the in the, that's attributed to Deep Throat in All the President's Men, which is really written by the William Golding, who wrote the screenplay. Is like, when he's talking about what happened in Watergate, he says to Bob Woodward, "Follow the money," you know. And that's all. Mm-hmm. That's my bottom line: is follow the money, and you'll seldom be mistaken. You know, and it's like, you just have to look. The concentration of wealth in the United States in the last 50 years is extraordinary, and all of these guys who are responsible for it just keep going, no matter what happens. Like, there was a great article in Rolling Stone magazine about a month ago by Matt Tabibi about why isn't anybody in Wall Street in jail?
Not only
are they not in jail, they all got many of them
bonuses.
They got bonuses, and the rest of them got appointed by Obama to the people, to the agencies that are going to regulate this. It's like, you got to be kidding me. Let's take this guy, we'll put him in a cabinet. Let's put this guy, we'll put him on a regulatory commission. I mean, it's like, geez, you know, the fox is in charge of the hen house. It's completely ludicrous, you know. And did you see, this guy that I think his name is Ferguson, that did the No End in Sight documentary, and he won the Academy Award for this documentary on the Wall Street meltdown, and called Inside Job.
He
got up, and before he accepted his Academy Award, he said, "I just want to point out that nobody's gone to jail. Not one person has gone to jail for this."
Yeah.
Now, you know, America imprisons more people per capita than any nation on earth. And if you get caught with, you know, a dime bag of whatever, or if you're distributing any amount of dope, you're going to prison, you know, and your chances of going, if you're black or if you're poor, increase exponentially, or any minority and you're poor, increase exponentially. But if you're white and you sit in a Wall Street office and you steal billions of dollars, You're not going to jail. It's, you know, again, this isn't all that complicated, you know, when you really look at it in simplistic, in straightforward terms. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? Like, I mean, it's so egregiously and so immensely wrong that you know, there's absolutely no defending it, and yet that's the way it is. And, you know, what's the matter with people that nobody's ever held accountable for this?
Yeah, and I think it's because the people who do it kind of own the police and at the upper levels. I mean, they...
Well, it's not just owning the police. It's just this pervasive. Well, I mean, it's partly that they run everything, like the justice system too. But mm-hmm. and as I say, they get appointed to the government after they do things, you know. But it's like there's this deflection of what people are concerned with in the general public that they don't hold these people accountable, you know. Like, I mean, the Tea Party reaction to it is kind of interesting on one level, until you find out that it's largely financed by the Koch brothers, who are like these super wealthy right-wing guys who own energy companies and like to pollute a lot and don't want to pay any fines for it. You know, I mean, there's some of the outrage that they express is legitimate, but it's like it's so much deeper than that. It's like I say, mm-hmm. like nobody ever talks in the United States, you know, a country that's mad about taxes, but nobody ever talks about how much of their taxes go to the military. The military budget is the biggest mm-hmm. boondoggle, in my opinion, in the American economy. It's like, you know, there's more money stolen right there than anywhere else. You know, like people get up in arms about welfare cheaters. Cripes, you gotta get all the welfare cheaters together. You wouldn't amount to one afternoon in the military.
Yeah, in the military.
Like,
yeah.
Seriously, like, you know, and you know, let's build more prisons to put all these evil people meaning, you know, lower income people, you know, in prison. But wait a minute. You know, the real criminals, like the super criminals, you know, they don't go to prison.
No, they don't.
They're not held accountable, and that's what's so bizarre about everything. You know, it's like everything, to bring it back to Gurdjieff, it's like, you know, people see things topsy-turvy, you know, like we have this mistaken impression about almost everything. And then I would say, like, it's very transparent in the political situation. And talking about the United States, I mean, it applies in Canada and Germany and Great Britain and all the so-called democracies, you know. It's like it's just so blatant in the United States, and there's just so much of it because there's so much money there, and it's such a big, powerful country that it's easy to focus on it there. It's like, it's almost kind of like... Mm-hmm. super magnified in the States for a variety of reasons, but like I say, I'm not in any way, this isn't an anti-American thing. It's anti, you know, everybody.
No, it's a problem around the world and all the countries of the world. I mean, the only few countries that aren't part of that system are those terrorist states like Iran.
or
Venezuela and Cuba.
You get a relatively supposedly communist country like China, and I mean, they're just as bad, if not worse. I mean, it's completely a totalitarian state, you know. They have population control. They have like massive surveillance systems in place in their cities, you know. Do you know that they have all sorts of outbreaks in China all the time, like thousands and thousands a year, anti-government protests and things, but you never...
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, apparently. Oh. I was quite shocked when I was reading this article. Again, this was in Rolling Stone a couple of years ago, and they were talking about this city where they... the city that exists, I think it's in... I don't even know the name of the city, but I think it's in south... It's on the ocean, so it's in the south... east part of China, and it didn't exist 30 years ago, basically, and it's this huge city where if you own a computer monitor, it was probably built there because it manufactures like an immense amount of computer technology and you know, high tech stuff, and apparently they have in place there this this system of surveillance, which is, I mean, it's the most advanced surveillance system of the population on the planet, apparently. Like, you can't move without being on camera, without... And
well,
then it was in that article that they were talking, and I forget the number. It was something like there's 10,000 demonstrations or outbreaks and protests against the government a year in China. Like, all over the place. It's such a massive country that, mm-hmm. you know, they're not coordinated and they're not centralized and it's not, they're not a direct threat to the government. But apparently, like, you know, there are just so many people who are so down and out that they've basically got nothing to lose, you know. So they have these massive suicides in these places where they amongst the workers, because it's so regimented and so depressing and just mm-hmm. they can't take it, they break down and they kill themselves.
I remember I've heard of that recently.
I mean, this is a communist country, you know, where the workers are going to control things, please, you know. They're just as bad, if not worse, you know, they are worse in many ways than the Western democracies, so called.
I mean, they work. They're very integrated into the same structure of the elites somehow. Like Kissinger was very involved with Mao with the population reduction efforts, and Mao got awards at the UN for the things he had done. I understood that Mao was supposed to, didn't he get rid of 50 to 60 million people? That's what I understood.
He didn't do it by population reduction methods. He did it by killing them and starving them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, China has a policy on reproduction, eh?
Yeah, one child policy.
But I mean, you know, Mao and Stalin and who else? Chiang Kai-shek, all who was Mao's opponent, all starved large groups of people. Like Stalin starved like something like 8 million people in the Ukraine or something.
Wow,
like that.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, and I talked to somebody one time, a historian, somebody who had done her PhD in history, and she focused on the Irish potato famine. We were talking about famines, and she said, well, you know, she talked about the political aspects of it, which I really didn't know anything about, and she said, "Well, you can never have a famine without a significant political, you know, element being involved. It's just not possible, you
mm-hmm.
know." And then I started thinking about it. Well, the ones I really know about are in China and in Russia, and clearly those were, you know, imposed by the government to punish a certain, you know, portion of the population. Like, I don't know how many people Mao killed, but it was, you know. There's at least 20 million, I know that. And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, business as usual for these guys, you know. Like, it's just, yeah.
Did you know, have you heard that...
Anything else cheery to talk about?
Yeah, did you hear that, two things, that apparently China's been given, like, hundreds of areas of land in the States. They're going to be called FTZs, free trade zones, and they're allowed to bring over their own workers and construct like factories there.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
They're going to, instead of having to ship them over the ocean, they're going to bring over. They've given, I think it's like 500 plots of land around the States. Isn't that wild? It's like, holy smokes, our world is changing. Kind of people don't realize what's been done. I think some people say that has to do with the indebtedness of the states to China.
Oh, yeah, there is that.
Giving them eminent domain over certain areas. I'm not really sure, but it's
not
terrible.
Sure how that's going to work. I don't think that's going to go over too well. But, I mean, yeah, they hold so much. I mean, China is, you know, hold so much paper on the United States that they can pretty much, that's why, again, you know, whenever people start pontificating about freedom and democracy, it's like, wait a minute, you know, like, wait a minute, you know, you at the same time as that you're, you know, railing against these nations in the Middle East and, you know, dictators and stuff, you're giving most favored nation trade status to China, which is perhaps probably the biggest human rights violators on the planet, you know. So it's like, I mean, again, the hypocrisy of it's oh yeah, you owe them a lot of money. Okay, now I understand.
We may have a little less freedom in Canada in the future. Did you hear? I'm not sure of the amount, but I think the Conservative government has just granted $1 billion extra dollars for building prisons in Canada.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Isn't that nice? I wonder who's going into prisons. I didn't know there was a crime wave. Is there a crime wave somewhere?
No, they actually crime is actually down. That's why it's so bizarre. I mean, it's like. Yeah. Yeah, they want to put you in for longer, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, like holy smokes.
In the States there's an incredible growth industry, you know.
I know. Yeah, that's good slave labor. I mean, they pay these people, the corporations make a lot of things in these prisons now, eh? Like they're paid 40 cents an hour for their labor. So it makes it comparable with Chinese labor.
Jeez. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Apparently, a lot of investment in having, you know, major companies, international companies, using the prisons for slave labor, essentially. You know, amazing. I would never have believed it. Okay. We've covered a number of news areas, Jim. I think what we should probably do, I'd mention to Seth in the studio there ahead of time that maybe we'd take 5 minutes on the hour and would play our song that we play there, A Sacred Land. And maybe when we come back, why don't we take our focus off kind of what's happening in the world at this time, and let's focus on Beelzebub's tales and pick up the story and try to explain some of the teachings of it.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yep.
And was there anything else you wanted to say?
Nope. No, actually,
we'll be back.
Okay.
We'll be back.
My grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. He brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. They will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. into the battleground, a warrior you will ride, armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.
Thank you. That's from Robin, a native elder from Western Canada, Sacred Land. Okay, so Jim, we were going to pick up on Beelzebub's tales and try to move along. We're kind of following this theme over. We'll follow it today and through the next couple shows, I think.
Yeah, sure.
We began, I'm going to do a quick review and say a little bit about what we covered last week.
Okay.
This is Gurdjieff's classic story called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And the setting of it, Beelzebub is on a spaceship, and he's traveling back, he's traveling to the solar system of the Pole Star, where he's going to attend a conference. And on his trip, he has his grandson, Hasin, there with him, and he has his longtime servant or attendant, Ahun, who accompanied him. Now, as Beelzebub's traveling to this conference, he undertakes to aid in the education of his grandson. And so what he does, he explains to him his own history in the solar system ORS, O-R-S, which is our solar system. And Beelzebub had been banished to the moon, and he had set up a telescope there, and he had observed the human beings on planet Earth through history. He visited the planet Earth 6 times altogether. And the first visit was at the time of Atlantis. And the second and third visits were to try to help reduce animal sacrifices which were being conducted on Earth. And these animal sacrifices were producing so much Ascoken vibration that it was interfering with the normal evolution of the moon and its atmosphere. So Beelzebub had come down, and when he comes down to the Earth, he comes down on his spaceship occasion, and they land usually on a waterway, and Beelzebub travels to a major, usually to a center of culture. And when he travels to these lands, he usually goes to what we would be a restaurant or a bar or some type of meeting place like that, a cafe. And so he would hang out at such places and interact and meet local inhabitants. So his Beelzebub's tales are an account of his various visits to the planet Earth and his observations of the three-brained beings breathing on that planet who had become so abnormal in their functioning. And particularly, the story of Beelzebub's tales deals with the issue of what are the causes of war, or what Gurdjieff calls the processes of reciprocal self-destruction. Okay, and Beelzebub says that these are just abnormal, and it's unknown elsewhere in the universe. And these strange beings on planet Earth, this is one of their chief, or this is their chief particularity, that they, of all creatures, have this horrific process of reciprocal destruction that occurs on that planet. So, in his fourth visit, Beelzebub visits the planet Earth to capture some apes. And he does this, and he visits the pyramids at the time of the early Egyptian period, when the pyramids are being constructed. And then his fifth visit, which we're going to pick up again on today, is at the time of Babylon. And Beelzebub explains that at that time, Babylon was under the control of a Persian king who had an obsession with gold. And he had heard, and he said, among power-possessing beings, if they have an interest in gold, it doesn't really matter what kinds of means that they use to get this gold. But anyway, he got the Persian king gathered together the learned beings of the city of Babylon, wanting to know from them the little secret of alchemy, because he had heard that you could turn base metals into gold. And when none of them knew the answer, then he went out to foreign lands, and he conquered them and brought their learned beings all to the city of Babylon. And this is partly what Beelzebub describes as building of the Tower of Babel, when you have all these learned beings in Babylon. And the initial aim was to try to discover, or the king had wanted to discover the cause or the methods of alchemy. But over time, the king became more enamored by his processes of reciprocal self-destruction, and so he lost interest in the issue of alchemy. And so there were all these learned beings in Babylon. And then we ended the last show. I was reading some of Beelzebub's description of being in Babylon and how the burning issue of the day had become the issue of the question of the existence of the human soul. And there were two completely opposite viewpoints. One was the theistic and one the atheistic. And the atheistic said there was no God and there was no soul. And the idealistic or the dualistic theory said that there was both a body and a soul. And it postulated all kinds of perturbations to the soul after death. And so this was the burning issue of the day when Beelzebub was in the city of Babylon. Now, Beelzebub's view is that he says this. He says, in talking to his grandson, he says, yes, on almost all the planets of that solar system also, three-brained beings dwell. And in almost all of them, higher being bodies can be coded. Higher being bodies, or as they are called on some planets of that solar system, souls, arise in the three-brained beings. Now, instead of having a atheistic or a dualistic view, Beelzebub explains that human beings, that we have a planetary body, and then we have the possibility of coding what he calls a Kesjan body, and then there is a third being body, which he calls the highest being body, which in other literature would be called your spiritual body or your mental body. So for Beelzebub, to attain one's soul means to coat and perfect these higher being bodies. Okay, and that's what is meant by the term to acquire one's soul. Okay, and a story often used to illustrate Gurdjieff's idea of the soul is told by Fritz Peters when he was a house boy and serving Mr. Gurdjieff in France. And there was an oak tree outside of their flat, and Gurdjieff asked Fritz Peters, how many acorns were there on the oak tree or on the ground around the oak tree? And the boy answered, well, that there were thousands of oak trees. And Gurdjieff asked him, well, how many of those acorns are likely to become oak trees? And the boy said, well, I don't know, maybe just a handful, maybe just one or two, maybe none at all. And Gurdjieff said to Fritz Peters, he says, so also with man. It's as though all of us are nuts or acorns, and we have the potential to become oak trees, which would mean to actually fulfill our evolutionary potential to become all that we might become and attain. But that, Gurdjieff says, similar as in nature, though, although there are all these acorns, most of them won't attain that. And instead, the acorns will break down and they'll go back, the elements in them will go back into the soil. And he said they might be become fertilizer for a future tree. So similarly with human beings, Gurdjieff says, like a soul isn't already given to a person as such, but has to be attained. And like nature, many of us acorns, we won't attain these higher possibilities, and so we can't be guaranteed of kind of blissfulness in heaven or paradise after death. Instead, it depends upon our own being particled duty, a term like our fulfilling our being obligations, and striving through our own life to attain our own I. That's another way in which Gurdjieff and Beelzebub talks about a human being, that we have to attain our own I. So that was the fifth trip of Beelzebub to the planet Earth, then focuses on this teaching, these issues concerning the soul. Okay, Jim, I'll just leave it open for you for a moment, just to anything you wanted to respond to of what I've been saying.
It's funny, like when you're just talking about that acorn story, you know, which we've been telling for 35 years or whatever. It's like, you know, it's a great story, but it's funny because it just sort of, I heard it a little bit differently this time in terms of like what an acorn is. It's like this seed. It's like this point source. That in a sense, you could relate that to the idea of the point source. And like, you know, we all come from that point source when we're, you know, as physical beings, when the egg is fertilized, and you think of it that like that's a little seed, that's a little acorn, and then we can become this miraculously complex physical organism with a head brain and a heart brain and, you know, a spinal cord brain and do all these amazing things and all these incredibly complex processes going on in the physical organism and in the subtle bodies. And when you think of it, it's like the idea is that we can develop these higher being bodies and these higher levels of consciousness. It's really not so miraculous when you consider what we come from in terms of just being this fertilized egg. What each of us like is a miracle. Like there used to be something in Henry Miller's bathroom, a piece of graffiti, don't look for miracles, you are the miracle. And in a way, I think we kind of forget how miraculous the transformation that each of us has undergone in terms of our own being here. And yet, what he's saying is that this idea of the soul is that it's something, it's a seed condition, but it's not fully realized, so that really everything that you do in your life in terms of your the level of consciousness and conscience at which you live is really the process of nourishing and cultivating the seed condition to realize the soul. Like the soul has to be realized. It's not something complete. And it's funny, like, you know, the acorn is like such an interesting little, you know, like illustration of that, in a sense, that little story he told to Fritz Peters, you know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I like that idea also of an acorn. You think of what an acorn, you plant it in the earth, so it requires the earth, and then you give it water, and it requires air, and it requires sunlight.
Yeah.
So it's like the acorn lives off, requires all four elements.
Yeah.
And similarly, a human being, the four elements are usually, the earth is related to our physical body, the water is related to our emotional or astral body, the air is related to the mind, and the fire is related to the spiritual principle. So the four elements represent those, like, four components, and so we are like those nuts, and we have to kind of assimilate the energies and impressions from these different realms and kind of out of that strive to synthesize or attain our soul through coding the higher being bodies. But it's quite an unusual teaching in the way of how, like in theosophy, it's like everybody has an astral body and we're all astral traveling at night and doing all these things, yeah. Whereas Gurdjieff has a very different emphasis.
Yeah,
he would say everybody has an astral body, but he would say it's not formed in people. So it's not truly a vehicle for consciousness and experience.
Yeah, he very clearly says that in other places, is that it's, you know, we have these bodies, but they're completely unnecessary given our level of consciousness and being, that they really only become operative and fulfill their real functions and become integrated into our being if we develop. I think he's quite different from most other esoteric teachings. I don't know. I mean, to a certain extent, there's different emphases in different teachings, but he is very radically on one end of the spectrum in terms of like what the soul is, because he really says that the soul is not developed and is not attained. If it's not attained, then it's not a permanent thing, and it's only really a permanent thing within a certain framework of the cosmos, like, because he says, you know, you can attain to immortality within the limits of the solar system. So even like the concept of immortality is limited by the cosmic schema in which human beings exist. So it's a very different perspective, I think, from even other esoteric teachings that I know of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting in the Uspenskian version of the Gurdjieff teachings. He seems especially to emphasize that a lot of souls can pass to the moon upon
right.
their death. Like, he says that also in Beelzebub's Tales. Like,
yeah.
Going back, I'll just step back a moment for people who don't recall the history. What Beelzebub says happened is a comet hit the planet Earth and broke off the moon and the secondary moon unknown to us, which has a very eccentric and larger orbit. And that in order for the moon to be stabilized after this collision, that was when organic life arose on the Earth. Because when any organic life form dies, it gives off a certain vibrational energy, which in a sense feeds the moon or passes to the moon. So the idea is organic life on Earth enables, it feeds the moon these vibrations to allow the moon's evolution in its own time. So the evolution of the moon's atmosphere. So Gurdjieff sometimes, though, he talks about how a person can be under the control of the moon. Like, we could think of such a person as a lunatic, okay, because that's the idea that the moon controls this. For Gurdjieff, it can control the negative emotions in people, madness of the mind, delusions, illusions. Okay, moon it represents false mind in a way. So if a person is said to be under 96 laws, then death, it said you can be drawn into the sphere of the moon so that the souls might actually pass to the moon. And there's a fascinating quotation from Adi Da. Oh, I think it's Adi Da, where he kind of had this psychic vision of these souls being enslaved on the moon in kind of work camp conditions and this kind of mental hell worlds. It's a very interesting footnote. Hey, Jim, you know the one I'm referring to?
Yeah, it rings a bell, and I seem to recall, I think it is Adi Da. I think it's him. I can't really place it, but I know I've read it because, because it was a very striking image, and I thought immediately, like, oh, that's kind of like what Gurdjieff says about feeding the moon and souls migrating.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly the same. He says that the soul feeds carnivorously off the souls of men.
Yeah.
And it's like that the beings are imprisoned there in the moon, in the sphere of the moon. And Gurdjieff, in Search of the Miraculous, identifies the dark side of the moon with, like, the hell worlds. He says,
yeah,
where there'll be gnarling and gashing of teeth. So the moon is kind of seen as this lower, outer outposts of the cosmos, so we can be drawn into this lower world upon our death. But Gurdjieff has the idea, see, a human being, when we die, we can feed different sources, because the inner, the mental body is associated with the sun, and the astral body is associated with the planetary sphere. So if the when a person dies, according to Beelzebub, his soul rises to its center of gravity, usually in the atmosphere, in the Kesgen body. So it's like there's astral worlds associated with the atmospheres. And Gurdjieff says that a person in their astral body, they can only live a certain period of time in the astral realm before they undergo another, what he calls, rascuerno, which is a term that means the separation of parts. So the first rascuerno is where you die physically and you leave behind the planetary body, but then you persist in your astral body, but you can be drawn into different levels of the atmosphere, or you might pass to the moon. And then after the death of the astral body, one needs to have attained the mental body before the dissipation of the astral body. So we'll go into these kinds of ideas a little bit more at a later point. But I guess to bring it back, we were going, Beelzebub's fifth visit at the time of Babylon, the great question of the day is whether or not a human being has a soul. And the Gurdjieff teaching, or the Beelzebub's teaching, is that we do have the possibilities of developing and attaining our higher being bodies and attaining our own I, but that ordinarily people don't do these things. So it's not that man does or does not have a soul. There's a saying he often used. Do you remember that saying, Jim?
Oh, blessed is he who has a soul, blessed is he who has not, but woe betide he who has one in the process of making, or something to that effect. Like,
yeah, something, yeah.
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 Like that, the situation is like that, really, that the making of the soul is related to suffering.
Related to suffering.
Yeah.
And Gurdjieff, and we'll come to that. Gurdjieff talks about how, he talks about what he calls a being part kadolge duty. And there are two aspects to that, conscious labors and intentional suffering. And these are part of how a human being has to strive towards their own self-perfection. Conscious labors and intentional suffering. So we'll come back to those a little bit more at a later point. But that's partly how one forges a soul.
Oh, by the way, Adi Da said, I remember once for a period of days I was aware of a world that appeared to survive in our moon. It was a superphysical or astral world where beings were sent off to birth on the Earth or other worlds, and then their bodies were enjoyed cannibalistically by the older generation on the moon, or they were forced to work as physical and mental slaves.
Wow. Yeah, that's excellent. That's good. I think that's quite consistent with what Gurdjieff said in his different writings.
Yeah.
I know, you know, another person who I heard elaborate similar viewpoints was that amazing artist, Alex Gray. You know, do you know who I mean?
Oh, I've heard the name, but I don't really know who that is.
Yeah. He does these pictures of human beings, which kind of shows the subtle anatomy and the energy vortexes and things like that. A very profound art. It's almost on a class of his own. He's like a Michelangelo almost. Remarkable work. And some of them... So I'd almost want to use one of his pictures for the title of the Heart Doctrine book because it was such a good representation of the kind of higher dimensional physics of the heart.
And he talks about the moon, too?
He had similar experiences on LSD.
Oh, really?
On LSD,
wow.
Of there being a world in the moon and it living off the souls of people. Yeah. He recounted this on Coast to Coast with George Inouye.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was a fascinating show, yeah. Okay, so, to come back to Beelzebub's tales. So his third trip was during this period in Babylon, and another maleficent fiction which arose at that time, from this time of Babylon, was the belief in there being paradise and hell. And I'll read a little bit of what Beelzebub. Well, this is. I'll read some of the new edition of the Slugs. Beelzebub explains to Hasin that these two teachings or theories, the atheistic and the dualistic, one affirming the soul and one denying it, began to pass down generation to generation with the fundamental ideas unchanged, even down to contemporary times. And it's interesting, Jim. I mean, it's still the issue, eh? It's still an issue in contemporary times, as it's always been. Yeah. Beelzebub then elaborates a further variation of the dualistic theory with origins in the Babylonian state. Quote, further, it was said that as soon as a man is born, two invisible spirits immediately perch upon his shoulders. On his right shoulder sits a spirit of good called an angel, and on his left a second spirit, a spirit of evil called a devil. From the very first days, these spirits, the spirit of good and the spirit of evil, record in their notebooks all the manifestations of the man, the spirit sitting on his right shoulder, recording all those called his good manifestations or good deeds, and the spirit sitting on his left shoulder, the evil. In this strange teaching, it was further said that these two spirit rivals are always combating each other, and that each strives with might and main that the man should do more of those actions which are in his domain. And when the man dies, these spirits leave his physical body on earth and take his soul to God, who exists somewhere up in heaven. There, up in heaven, this God sits surrounded by his devoted archangels and angels, and suspended in front of him is a pair of scales. On each side of the scales, spirits stand on duty. On the right stand the spirits, who are called servants of paradise, and these are the angels. And on the left stand the servants of hell, and these are the devils. The spirits which have sat on man's shoulder all his life bring his soul after death to the God, and God then takes from their hands the notebooks in which the notes have been recorded of all the man's actions, and he places them on the pan of the scales. And according to which pan which falls, God commands the spirits on duty standing on the given side to take this soul into their charge. In the charge of the spirit standing on duty on the right is just that place called paradise. In the charge of the spirit standing on duty on the left of the scales, who, according to this Babylonian teaching, are the devils, there is what is called hell. Okay, now paradise is described as of indescribable beauty and splendiferousness, with magnificent fruit and enchanting sounds, and those things, quote, according to the perception and cognitions abnormally inherent in them, are as likely to invoke great satisfaction. Okay, so he's saying that this what's in this paradise is all that we would be satisfied with according to all those perceptions and cognitions abnormally inherent in us. Anyway, that is to say, the satisfaction of those needs formed in their common presences, which are criminal for three centered beings to possess. Concerning hell, it was said that it is a place without vegetation, always unimaginably hot, and without a single drop of water. In that hell, sounds constantly echo of fearful cacophony and infuriating offensive abuse. Everywhere there are instruments of every conceivable torture, from the rack and the wheel to instruments for lacerating bodies and mechanically rubbing them with salt, and so on of the same kind. Okay, this Babylon teaching was to encourage men to strive while on earth to provide more materials for the spirit angel sitting on one's right shoulder rather than that on his left, in which case a man's soul would inevitably go to this most awful hell. Okay, so this is Gurdjieff explaining one of what he calls a maleficent fiction, meaning a wrong idea, destructive wrong idea about what happens after the soul, after death. Even though there are elements to this that aren't inconsistent with Gurdjieff, like Gurdjieff is saying the whole soul does exist after death, and it can be drawn into more or less favorable circumstances. Okay, so at this point in the tales, Hussein interrupts his grandfather, wanting to understand more what of their manifestations would be considered good and which bad. Beelzebub explains then that there are two ways of understanding this, having nothing in common with each other, but having existed from ancient to modern times. The first of these understandings derives from the Alcadian society from the period of Atlantis. Now, this Alcadian society was a genuine society of mystics, or learned society that Beelzebub's dates back to the time of Atlantis. Okay, so their understanding of morality retained by the initiates, and according to this view, every action of man is good in the objective sense if it is done according to his conscience, and every action is bad if from it he later experiences remorse. So, according to Beelzebub, that is the principal definition of morality according to this ancient Akkadian society. It has to do with this faculty of remorse. And so, something is good or bad as to whether you would subsequently experience remorse or not for having committed that act. This, Jim, seems like a major emphasis in Beelzebub's tales is the importance of people of the capacity of remorse of conscience. Gurdjieff seems to assign a central role in it, not only in Beelzebub's tales, but also to his teachings with Uspensky. Conscience and the remorse of conscience is assigned a particularly important role in terms of human's transformation.
Yeah, and I think, I've said this before, and I think, like, broadly speaking, I think, like, the presentation of his teaching and that appears in Uspensky's work and In Search of the Miraculous, which is more formal and formally an intellectual exposition, is really addresses the development of consciousness, and I think more in Beelzebub's tales, which is an allegory and which is indirect teaching, I think it's more emotionally directed and is intended to awaken and nourish conscience, and I think that's a huge emphasis in Beelzebub's tales, is that people don't have conscience, but that by developing conscience and by having remorse of conscience, they can affect the transformation of their consciousness and being. It's a very interesting differentiation in the presentation of the teaching as it appears in Search of the Miraculous and that which appears in Beelzebub's tales. It's quite different, quite a different emphasis.
Yeah, and yet similar too.
It's so interesting, but it's more of a matter of emphasis but just approaching things from a different angle in a sense.
Yeah. In Beelzebub's tales, Beelzebub explains that through different periods in human history, there have been sacred individuals actualized from above. That's a phrase Beelzebub uses, actualized from above, who on earth were to try to help humankind relieve themselves of those properties of the consequences of the effects of the Orgenkunde buffer, which we talked about last week, which was supposed to have been implanted in humankind to make people perceive reality topsy-turvy and to pursue all the time pleasure, the experience of pleasure. So these different sacred messengers, and in the book, Beelzebub mentions, he calls them Saint Buddha, Saint Lama, Saint Moses, Jesus Christ, Ashiashimash, particularly, who's, I'm not sure historically if that is supposed to correspond to any known figure. Beelzebub relates his work to the period before the time of Babylon. And one thing that Gurdjieff says is that these sacred individuals actualized from above tried to aid humankind through evoking in them the three sacred being impulses of faith, hope, and love. But Beelzebub explains, because the human psyche became so degenerate, human beings no longer experience the sacred being impulses of faith, hope, and love. And so the teachings of these traditional teachers hadn't worked. And then Ashiashimash, he was actualized from above, and his aim had been to help transform conditions on earth through the awakening of the remorse of conscience. And in the tales, Ashiashimash at one point became very successful, and this religion or teaching of his had spread throughout the region, and it had kind of, for a period of time, completely stopped the wars. But subsequently, other events occurred which may, over time, led to the destruction of all the labors, the results of the labors of Ashiashimash. So Gurdjieff or Beelzebub regards the remorse of conscience as this fourth sacred being impulse. And he saw, in terms of understanding the psychopathology of man and the causes of war, we see that a major role is played by what Gurdjieff calls husnamus individuals. And we'll talk a lot about this next week. What he means by this, and I don't know the derivation of this term husnamus. It's spelt H-A-S, like has, na, N-A-M-U-S-S, husnamus. But the main definition is one in whom there is no longer any divine impulse of conscience. So husnamus individuals are people who lack this being impulse of capacity for conscience, or of what Beelzebub calls objective shame. He says that there's an objective shame that a person might experience. And in the tales, these husnamus individuals, it's due to husnamus individuals through time that the divine teachings of all the sacred individuals actualized from above, over time, they're distorted more and more. And all the husnamus individuals then use these teachings to their own husnamus or selfish ends, and they distort those teachings further. So we'll talk more about what the husnamus individuals are and the husnamus impulses next week. But the major reason of the causes of war, according to Beelzebub, are these husnamus individuals who lack this capacity for the experience of conscience. And then he explains, Jim, to his grandson, he explains, so Hussein asked him, okay, well, that's what the initiates from Atlantis, you know, that was their definition of what is good or bad, according to whether or not things offended the conscience. And then he explains the morality of the second form of morality, which he compares to a chameleon. A chameleon is an animal that's so changeable and adaptive. And this is what Beelzebub, quote, says about the second morality. And the oddity and peculiarity of this said particularity of the morality there, especially of contemporary morality, is that its functioning automatically depends entirely on the moods of the local authorities, which moods in their turn depend upon automatically on the state of the four sources of action there existing there under the names of mother-in-law, digestion, John Thomas, and cash. So in the early 1900s, the term John Thomas represented the penis. So what he's saying is the four sources of action characteristic of the humans on planet Earth are mother-in-law, digestion, like wanting to eat in your stomach, John Henry, and cash. It's so funny, Jim. Sometimes
it's like, well, think about that though. Like your mother-in-law, it's like sort of misplaced conscience, you know, like hearing the opinions of others is governing your actions. Your stomach, you know, like eating, and your penis, sex, and cash is like the corruption of the heart.
So that's the new morality.
Yeah, it's so good.
It depends on local authorities, and what the local authorities' moods depend on are those four characteristics.
There's some quote in one of the I think it's Guru Bawan or somebody that you quote in one of your books, but it's not this quote, but he essentially says something like basically all human motivation is related to sex, eating and drinking and coveting materialism or something. It's really good because he just basically boiled it down to like the most base functions of the human organism, like the three lower chakras, sex, money, and power, He says it so well, and it's very reminiscent of, like, what Gurdjieff is saying here. It's, like, so good. I just want to say that I think Ashiata Shimash, I was trying to find this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Beelzebub. I know somewhere that I read that the derivation of Ashiata Shimash had something to do with, like, the Persian sun god, and that he's like a solar being, like that's what the translation of the name means. And I think he's supposed to be, I believe he's supposed to be like akin to Zoroaster.
Oh yeah. Oh.
Historically, and then as far as Hasnamas, I mean, on one very simple English level, has no mass, like has no substance.
Has no mass.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really nice. I like that.
Yeah.
Has no mass.
Like when he talks about terrestrial nullities, it has no mass. It's like they're beings without any substance.
Wow. That's excellent. That's really appropriate. That's a valuable way of remembering it. Has no mass.
Yeah. Because there's so many terms like in the tales where, you know, at times, like Gurdjieff sort of joked about, like he looked out the window, he'd sort of pluck something off a sign and he put it in the book and made up a term, you know. But other things, very definitely, like Lentrol Hamsamin, basically, the beginning of that is like from Lenin and Trotsky.
A
person who undoes everything and is a ultra rationalist, like the beginning of that is Lenin and Trotsky, eh?
Oh yeah. Oh. Yeah. Oh, those two words are in it.
Yeah.
Oh, is that ever clever? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, there are many terms like that where he, there's some that just seem completely nonsense. And then, but of course, you have to know languages too. Bennett's good at that because he spoke several languages, just relating it to different like terms. I'm almost sure that it was in Bennett where I read this, where he has, but I couldn't find it. I thought it was in Gurdjieff Making a New World. I know I've read this where he talks about the derivation of Ashiata Shimash, and it's related to the Persian sun god. I know that for sure. So.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah.
And so he's like that. The idea is like he's a solar incarnation, like he's a being of light from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, it's funny. Gurdjieff has such eccentric language uses. Interesting topic is like, why did he use the word Beelzebub? Because isn't the word Beelzebub usually associated with the devil? And I found this interesting passage from The Arousing of Thought, from the introduction to his book, where Gurdjieff's talking about the book. I'd just like to read this. I think it's quite funny. Please, reader, do not worry. I shall, of course, also write of the earth, but with such an impartial attitude that this comparatively small planet itself and also everything on it shall correspond to that place which, in fact, it occupies and which, according to your own sane logic, arrived at, thanks, of course, to my guidance, it must occupy in our great universe. I must, of course, also make the various what are called heroes of these writings of mine not such types as those which in general the writers of all ranks and epochs on earth have drawn and exalted. That is to say, types such as any Tom, Dick, or Harry, who arise through a misunderstanding. I like that, who arise through a misunderstanding. And who fail to acquire, during the process of their formation, up to what is called responsible life, anything at all which it is proper for an arising in the image of God, that is to say, a man, to have, and who progressively develop in themselves to their last breath only such charms as, for instance, lasciviousness, slobberiness, amorousness, maliciousness, chicken-heartedness, enviousness, and similar vices unworthy of man. Like, I think that's so funny how he just brings in, like, you know, my hero is not going to be any Tom, Dick, or Harry. He's so funny.
Yeah, very clever.
And then he goes on to explain from that, well, he says that, he suggests that people really don't understand the meaning of Beelzebub himself because of their famous what is called religious morality, which has obscured what Beelzebub really was or who he was. But in the book, Beelzebub is not supposed to represent the devil. In fact, Beelzebub is a being who's attained a higher level of divine reason. And he, at the end of the story, when Beelzebub arrives back at the center of the universe, he goes through a sacred ceremony and the horns on his head begin to grow again, because when he was on the earth, he lost his horns. And with each branch of the forks on his horns, that meant he had attained a higher and higher level. And Beelzebub's horns branch four times, indicating that he had attained this very high level of objective reason. And in the book, so Beelzebub isn't the devil, but he rather is an individual who's kind of lived in the solar system for millennia and he's a grandfather to his grandson, so he's an older man, and he's attained this body of knowledge and wisdom through his life experiences. So he represents someone who's attained objective reason, and because of this, is trying to provide what he describes as an impartial view on the life of humankind. So he's trying to look at the life of humankind as you might see it from someone from another planet might see it, like how insane it is. So, I just wanted to make that note a little bit about, I think sometimes people hear Beelzebub's tales to his grandson and they immediately get the wrong impression, the wrong association to that term Beelzebub.
Yeah.
And then he also said in that little chapter, he also says he wants to, if he uses Beelzebub's tale, Beelzebub's name, he knows that Beelzebub will, because of his vanity, will pay attention and will help him with his writings. Some silly thing like that. Okay, so, we've only got 5 minutes left, so maybe just when we were off air between the breaks, Jim, you started saying at one point, you came back to the quote from Beelzebub where he talks about a particle of all that exists. And he uses that term several times in Beelzebub's tales. And so you might think of each human being has within them like a particle of all that exists. So we're all, in a way, we're all a particle of all that exists within this kind of infinite being of our endlessness. It's a nice phrase, a gem, a particle of all that exists. And you were mentioning about how it reminded you of the idea of non-locality.
Well, I just was just saying, and we can maybe pick this up the next time and talk a little bit about this, because there are other phrases where he talks about similitudes of a whole in Beelzebub's tales. But I just realized that, and I'm trying to kind of think about what esotericism says about the nature of reality and the nature of human beings, and like I really kind of see more clearly like the existence of a holographic principle in esoteric teachings on both a cosmic and a psychological level, and it leads to such a dramatically different understanding of the nature of reality and consciousness, and makes sense of is given by the experience of cosmic consciousness, as for instance what we've discussed with respect to Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness, and how that really anticipates the whole idea of non-locality, and which has been discovered in contemporary physics, and how unsettling that idea is in physics, because it really shows that the relativity of all knowledge in physics that applies to the four-dimensional time-space, that the whole Newtonian clockwork universe is obviously overthrown, but the need to postulate these different levels, higher levels, subtler levels of existence, as in the work of David Bohm. So there's a whole bunch of different ideas that are sort of linked together, but I see more and more how important that is in kind of dealing with the question of how esotericism anticipates, as you mentioned earlier, anticipates ideas in modern physics when you were talking about Madame Blavatsky. There are clearly many examples, and the more you understand esotericism, I think, and the more you understand what modern science is saying, particularly in terms of physics, the more you realize what intriguing questions arise, and you realize, like I would say, like in your model of consciousness, that I think this is very much underlines the need for a model in which human beings are regarded as multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe, and how they somehow incorporate the same principles and on different levels, and so, you know, it's a big mouthful and a lot to think
about. Yeah, and it's all like the idea of microcosm of the macrocosm,
yes,
or as above, so
below.
Like,
yeah,
these ancient axioms have expressed that same idea.
Yeah,
yeah. We'll come back to this.
How those ideas are, you know, and how complicated they are, like, and you can understand them on a whole different variety of levels. So. Yeah.
Yeah, the new ideas of modern physics let us understand those on a different way, because they show us a little bit of the possible physics of it,
yes,
like the, as you say, non-locality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I noticed we're just coming down to the end. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll pick up with Beelzebub's tales, and we'll go through the haws and the musses and talk about the psychopathology of humankind. I hope we're all around and
say a prayer for Japan.
Say a prayer for Japan. Yeah, just really quite tragic things happening around the world. It's a troubled time, and we all got to remember those sacred being impulses of faith, hope, and love, and be willing to look at our lives and experience remorse of conscience for what we've allowed to happen in our societies. I think the human race as a whole, in a way, needs to experience that remorse of conscience. Hey, Jim? To wake up to the things we've allowed to be done through the centuries and decades. The destructiveness, is really quite horrifying. Okay, so, but meanwhile, while from our observatory here on Mars, we'll keep our eye open on the strange three-brained beings on planet Earth.
Yeah.
Thank you, Seth and Don and Doug at BBS Radio, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Chris. Bye.
Goodbye.